choose for herself, was it? Not if she had any better prospects in the world. He'd never given that sort of thing much thought before. But since meeting Chantrea after arriving in Phnom Penh for the whole Gant, Sorm, Van, and Brolio, he was starting to see things differently. Chantrea was a nice girl from a good family, living on the edge of poverty, trying to get a psychology degree and earning a little money on the side, working the bar scene. Was that really by choice? And had he been helping her or taking advantage? And how many of these girls had no choice at all but were actually being coerced? Coerced by people like Sorm? And trapped by people like you? Was that true? Was he like, what, someone selling a fix to an addict? That seemed oversimplified. Or was he just telling himself it seemed that way because denial was more comfortable? What is with you, man? He didn't know. Maybe this whole experience in Cambodia, and now Thailand, would evolve him. He supposed he hoped it would, but he wasn't going to have much chance to evolve if he was dead. And if he didn't get his head straight before going into the hotel and taking care of business, it wouldn't exactly be improving his odds of living. You're okay, amigo. Shake it off. You just need to focus. Right. He blew out a long breath and texted Kanazaki. About to head over to the meeting. Is there a friend there? Yes. Say the word and I'll make sure the door is unlocked. Roger that. Expect to hear from me within the hour. He purged the messages, shut down the phone, and put it in its case, and headed over to Hotel Ruby. It was past midnight when he got there, and if the place had seemed lively during the day, that was nothing. The lobby was twice as crowded now, cacophonous with echoed conversation, and when he stepped off the elevator onto the club level, there was actually a line of people waiting to get in, everybody looking ghostly under black lights. Music was pulsing from inside the entrance doors, and three no-bullshit-looking guards sporting sidearms were wanding everyone before letting them pass, the former Royal Thai Marines Kanazaki had warned him of. Yeah, they looked like tough hombres, too, fit, unsmiling, and businesslike, the kind of men who did their job and did it well, whether the job in question was running a metal detector or shooting you dead. While he waited in line, he glanced around, foolishly hoping he might see the pretty lady. He didn't, of course. Though maybe she'd be inside. As he got closer, he started grinning and grooving a little to the dance music. When he reached the guards, he placed his cell phone on a plastic tray and said, "How y'all doing tonight?" One of them gave him a curt nod that suggested this guy had seen it all before and found none of it interesting. He moved the wand methodically from Dox's scalp to the soles of his feet. Then he examined the cell phone, handed it back to Dox, and nodded again. Dox put his palms together in a Y. "Thank you, sir, for the vote of confidence and for the important work you do here." Then he moved inside, into a roiling sea of laser lights and lithe bodies dancing to throbbing house music, the air heavy with the smells of aftershave and dance sweat and fruit cocktails. There were fog machines at work, too, or haze machines, or who could say what, but the dance floor was filled with billowing clouds cut by roving overhead colored lights. He threaded his way through the crowds, circumambulating the place, trying not to get distracted because, my God, if some of these women aren't straight-up tens, then a ten just doesn't exist. Of course, the lady he was really hoping to see was that intriguing one from earlier, but he saw no sign of her. He told himself that was good. If she was back, it could only mean she was a pro, and things might get complicated. But even so, he would have liked to see her. Well, just ships that had passed in the night, he supposed, and probably for the best. He made sure to stay screened by a healthy number of people as he moved past Sorm's VIP room. Okay, three black-clad dudes flanked in a semicircle in front of a big, solid-looking door, a red velvet rope line just behind them keeping the crowds back. The men were scanning the club and looked at least as badass as the Thai Marines by the entrance. Earpieces, combat boots, and armored vests. No sidearms he could see, but if these guys weren't packing heat in small of the back holsters, he was Fred Flintstone. He rolled on by, flowing with the crowd, and came to the karaoke room where he'd emplaced his gear. He'd been hoping it would be unoccupied, but knew by virtue of Murphy's Law he wouldn't be that lucky. And indeed, when he peeked through the door window, he saw a group of a half dozen young Americans, college boys and girls from the look of them, Happy and prosperous, with their drinks and their feet resting on the ottoman, one of the boys belting out something into a microphone, his expression suggesting that whatever it was, he was really feeling it. It would have been easier if he'd had some kind of hotel uniform. On the other hand, in his experience, the main thing in these matters was act as if, and he'd never met anyone who could act as if quite the way he could. Okay, he thought, here we go. He pushed open the door and strode in with great purpose. The guy with the microphone was singing, "Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me," and not doing a half-bad job of it either. He was so intent on his musical stylings that he didn't even hear Doc's come in, but the others looked up. "Excuse me," Doc said loudly. "I apologize on behalf of hotel management for the interruption, but we have a report of unsafe furniture in this room." The door swung shut behind him, cutting off the worst of the dance music from outside. They all looked at him with more or less identical, "what the hell?" expressions, with the exception of the kid with the mic, who also looked crestfallen. Docs understood. He'd been singing the part about how his cuts need love to help them heal, and that was about the best moment in the whole song. The singer lowered the mic, and for a moment the room was filled with nothing but the wordless orchestra. One of the girls, a pretty little blonde number in a silver cocktail dress so form-fitting that if it wasn't painted on, Docs didn't know what was enabling her to draw air, said, "What?" "Thank you, ma'am. If I could trouble you to just pause the music, I need to check that ottoman." They all looked at each other. The blonde shook her head as though to clear it. "What?" she said again. "Please, ma'am, this should really take no more than a minute. We've received a report that the ottoman in this room is structurally unsound. Whether from a defect in its manufacture or because of misuse, we have not yet determined. The hotel takes very seriously its responsibility to ensure the safety of all its guests and club patrons. So please, although it is a lovely song, and sir, you are doing a very fine job of singing it, if you could please pause the Elton John." The girl looked dumbfounded and shook her head again, but she did pick up the remote and, after searching for a moment, pressed a button. Beyond the bass notes of dance music from the surrounding club, the room was suddenly quiet. "Thank you, ma'am. That is very helpful. I need to check that ottoman, and it has been my experience in over 30 years of furniture inspections that music and safety do not mix. Now, if I could have those of you with your feet up on the ottoman, slowly lift them. Slowly, sir, please. I don't want to take a chance on anyone injuring themselves, and place them on the floor. And now your drinks. Feel free to enjoy them, but we need the glassware off that unsafe ottoman for just a moment." They all moved their feet and lifted their drinks, staring at him as though trying to decide whether he really was an authority figure or whether he was crazy, or maybe both. He'd been lucky so far. Alcohol was unpredictable, sometimes making people more susceptible to a little social engineering, other times less so. He stepped close to the ottoman, reached under the edge, and popped it up on its side so it was between him and the college kids. "My God," he said, "this is terrible, even worse than I feared. Someone could have been badly injured." He reached into the hole he'd created, felt the butt of the supergrid, and quickly extracted it, slipping it into the belly band under his shirt. Then he did the same with the spare mags, the Emerson, and the flashbang. When he was done, he returned the ottoman to its normal position, then stood and held up the broken pieces of plywood. "You would be amazed at the number of injuries caused each year by defective ottomans," he said, looking at each of them in turn. "I'm relieved no one has been harmed tonight. Please go back to your socializing, and ma'am, I have to add, that is an absolutely stunning dress. Silver becomes you. Enjoy the party, and you don't need to worry about this piece of furniture any longer, but I would advise for safety's sake that you refrain from placing your feet on it until such time as we have completed more comprehensive repair operations." The singer shook his head. "What the? You're saying we were in danger from the ottoman?" "In these matters, sir, it's hard to say how much, but it's certainly better not to take chances. The main thing is, you're perfectly safe now, and the ottoman has been defused. Thank you again for your cooperation, and again, please enjoy Club Les Nuits." He walked out without a backward glance, cutting through the fog and lasers and gyrating crowds on the dance floor to the other side of the club, and then heading to the restroom closest to Sorm's VIP room. The guards were still flanking the VIP room door and scanning their surroundings, but he was in ghost mode now, and they took no notice of him. The bathroom was crowded, most of the urinals occupied, and a dozen young Thais and Westerners adjusting their gelled hair and smoothing their plucked eyebrows in front of the mirrors. The music was loud, too, almost as loud as it was out on the dance floor. He tossed the plywood scraps into a trash can propped at the apex of a spiraling steel base and went into a stall, where he double-checked the supergrade. Full magazine, cartridge in the chamber, good to go. He eased the weapon back into the belly band and let his shirt drape over it. Okay, showtime. He stepped out of the stall, pausing to wash his hands for form's sake. He dried them under a jet-loud blower and turned to the door to go. One of the drunken Americans, the singer, rolled in, saw him, and just stood there. Ah, shit. Shame on him for not having checked his back. He hadn't been expecting any trouble from a bunch of college kids, or it might have been just a coincidence. Either way, he could tell from how the kid's mouth was thinning out into a determined line, he was going to have to deal with it. Bro, the kid said, what was that? You're not really hotel maintenance. Ingratitude is one of the indignities of my profession, son, he said, rubbing his cleaned hands together. I save people from potential peril, and they thank me by questioning my credentials.
Speaking of credentials, I'd like to see some.
You are more than welcome to lodge a complaint with my supervisor if doing so will make you feel better, but I have duties to perform.
He started to move past the kid, and the idiot actually grabbed him by the arm. Docs took hold of the kid's wrist in his free hand, broke the grip, and squeezed hard enough to make it hurt, at the same time communicating to the kid with the quickness and ease of the move that the pain he was feeling was nothing but a coming attraction if the kid was dumb enough to want the full movie. He stared into the kid's eyes.
Son, he growled, if you don't get your dumb ass back to Elton John right fucking now, I will reach down your throat, pull out your liver, and beat you to death with it. Comprende?
The kid didn't even try to break loose. He just lost some color and gave two quick nods. Docs saw some people looking. Shit. He let the kid go.
And be sure to wash your hands when you're done in here. I can't abide improper restroom hygiene.
He headed out, circling wide of Sorm's VIP room and pausing far enough from the bathroom and with enough people in the way to ensure the kid wouldn't see him when he exited. He relaxed and retracted his energy, the way he did when he was in a sniper hide, just going away and making himself invisible in plain sight. After a minute, the kid came out and headed in the direction of the karaoke room, still looking a little pale.
Okay, Sorm, he thought, here we fucking go.
He took a deep breath and shifted back into character, heading obliquely across the dance floor toward the VIP room, the gyrating people parting before him, their movements weirdly robotic under the pulsating lights. He boogied to the music like someone who'd had way too much to drink, pausing to dance here and there with some of the ladies he passed, sometimes to their apparent annoyance, sometimes to their apparent delight. He'd dated a dancer years back, and she had insisted on teaching him the basics, cha-cha and rumba and the tango, which was the only one he really liked. He hadn't minded. He was always up for something he thought might be foreplay, but he'd never expected any of it to be operationally useful. And yet, look at him now. He cleared the floor but kept on dancing. The guards were only 20 feet away now, and there was nothing between him and them but a handful of people and some fog from the machines. 15 feet. He swayed his hips and shoulders and rolled his arms and threw in a pirouette for good measure. The guards weren't scanning now. They were looking right at him, and their looks weren't the least bit friendly. 10 feet.
Hey, he called out, doing a little box step. That's the VIP room, ain't it? What's the cost of dancing there?
Chapter 21. Livia was on a stool at the far end of the bar closest to Sorm's VIP room, sipping a cosmopolitan from a martini glass. She'd retrieved the Glock from where she'd hidden it, and now it was immediately accessible via a cross-draw in the bag she was wearing on her left side, a strap over her right shoulder. The purse was a little large for the skimpy black cocktail dress she was wearing, but there were plenty of women in the club with outsized bags. Some of them were pros, carrying the tools of their trade. Others were just party animals packing a change of clothes for the morning after a hoped-for hookup. Her own excuse, of course, in addition to the Glock, was the night vision gear. The only other thing that might have looked slightly out of place was her choice of flats as footwear. Heels would have been more the look for clubbing, but on the other hand, for a night of dancing, sometimes the priority had to be comfort, or, in her case, speed and mobility. But none of it really mattered. If the dress was short and tight enough, men didn't notice the accessories. The platinum wig and oversized horn-rimmed glasses weren't standard fashion choices either, she supposed, but they'd be better than nothing against any video recordings. She'd been chatting briefly with an Australian guy who'd come over to hit on her, their heads inclined just a few inches apart so they could hear each other over the club music. But when she'd refused his offer to buy her a drink and told him she was meeting a friend, he'd moved on. That was fine. She'd wanted a few minutes to scan the club from this position and get a feel for the guards outside Sorm's VIP room. Those few minutes were done now. She was ready. She wiped the stem of the martini glass with a napkin and took out her phone. Her heart started hammering, and she breathed slowly and deeply for a minute until she felt calmer. Then she called Little. "Can you hear me?" she said, turning her head away from the people next to her so she could shout.
"Barely. Sounds like quite a party over there."
She glanced around.
"It is. Are you ready?"
"Say the word and I kill the lights and open the locks."
She got up, unzipped the purse, and circled the edge of the dance floor in the direction of the VIP room, her heart hammering hard again.
10 seconds,
she said.
"I'm with you."
She kept moving. She was 40 feet away now. The music was loud, pulsing. Laser lights crisscrossed the floor in front of her. The dance floor was packed with undulating bodies, arms in the air, everybody moving, fog from hidden machines rolling and rising around them. She pulled the goggles from the bag and fired them up.
8 seconds.
"Still with you. On your mark."
30 feet. There were maybe 50 people between her and the guards now. Her concealment was getting thin. She dangled the goggles low, holding them by the head strap so she could pull them on instantly. 20 feet. Just a little closer. She wanted it to go down fast. No time for anyone to react.
5, she said. 4. 3.
A big guy emerged from the crowds of the dance floor to her left and called out to the guards.
"Hey, that's the VIP room, ain't it? What's the cost to dance in there?"
Even if she hadn't seen him, she would have known from the voice alone. Texas.
What the hell?
"Wait," she said. "Not yet."
"Standing by."
What the hell?
She thought again. The guards were looking at Texas, looking at him hard. Whatever he was trying to pull off, she thought he had maybe 3 seconds before he got preempted.
"Is that rope line behind you Corinthian velour?"
Texas called out, still moving in.
"Rich Corinthian velour, just like in my ancestral home in Abilene."
Then he did a weird little jig and spun in a circle. And as his back turned to the guards, a gun came out from under his shirt like a magic trick. One of the guards saw the move, or at least recognized that Texas was way too close and that his hands had momentarily disappeared. The guard's hand swept behind his back. Texas finished his spin, the gun coming up en route, and the guard started to shout something in Thai, maybe, "Gun!" But Texas stopped him with a round right to his forehead. An instant later, he put another round into the head of the guard next to him, and another into the third, the shooting so fast and certain that all three were shot before the first had even hit the ground. The shots were loud and unmistakable even over the pulsating music. She heard shouts from the dance floor, the sounds of confused conversation. Texas stepped over the bodies, straight through the velour rope line, spun so his back was to the door, and blasted it right under the handle with a donkey kick. The door flew open. 3 men in black uniforms and tactical armor were standing just beyond it, guns drawn. Texas, already bent low from the kick, cried out, "Oh, shit!" and simultaneously dove away and tossed something backward into the room. The men saw it. One of them shouted, "Grenade!" in English. Without thinking, Livia spun away and yelled into the phone, "Cut the lights!" The club instantly went dark. There was a gigantic boom and a flash of light from inside the room. And then another boom and flash and another and more. Not a grenade, she realized. A flashbang. She pulled on the goggles and got out the Glock. There was pandemonium behind her, people shouting, stampeding away. The lights in Sorm's VIP room were still on. It must have been on a separate system as part of some sort of safe room. The room was empty now. The three soldiers, or whatever they were, had spilled out into the club, and they must have managed to move before the flashbang went off, because it looked as though they could still see, their guns up in two-handed grips as they tried to acquire a target. One of them got off two shots. The rounds hit the floor to the left of Texas. Texas rolled the other way and fired twice from his back, hitting the soldier in the chest. The soldier spun away. He might have been hurt, but with the body armor, he definitely wasn't out of the fight. Another of the soldiers circled right. They were going to flank Texas. Their vision might have been okay, but she could see that the concussive effect of the flashbang had messed up some of their coordination. Still, even if Texas could get off headshots and obviate the body armor, 3-on-1, he wasn't going to make it. Texas rolled and shot twice again. The guy who was flanking him jerked from the impact of the bullets, but again, they were chest shots. In the dim light from the VIP room, Texas probably couldn't see the armor, or rolling around on the floor, center mass was the best he could manage, or both. The third guy moved the other way, hugging the wall. The first guy leveled his pistol, and Texas shot at him again. The round went past the guy's face. Texas had figured out the problem, but there was too much going on, and his position was too poor. Texas shot again. This time, the round caught the guy in the face, and he went down. But while Texas had been engaging him, the third guy had moved stealthily along the wall and was bringing up his gun. Lydia took aim and fired. The first round caught the guy just below the throat. She moved in and kept shooting, walking up the barrel a notch as she closed. Her second and third rounds were both headshots. The guy went down. Texas whipped his head in her direction and simultaneously started to bring his pistol around, but then whipped his head and the pistol forward again. Even in all the craziness, he must have sensed that wherever the shots had come from, they hadn't been intended for him. "What the fuck?" he cried out. And then he rolled again, and just in time, too, because the second guy fired and put two rounds in the carpet where Texas's body had been just an instant earlier. Seeing he'd missed Texas, the second guy swung his gun around to try to acquire Livia. He was too far to risk a headshot, so she sighted center mass and eased back the trigger, moving in as she fired. Once, twice. A third shot. He twitched from the rounds. She brought up the muzzle and took aim at... There was a boom to her right and blood erupted from the side of the guy's head. While he'd been engaging her, Texas had sighted in the finishing shot. Livia looked around wildly. People were running in all directions, screaming and shouting. The house lasers were still crisscrossing through the darkness, the music still thumping. She didn't see any more opposition. She glanced at Texas. He was still on his back, his head raised off the floor and swiveling left and right, his gun up and extended in a two-handed grip.
"What the fuck?"
he cried out again, without even looking at her.
"Where's Sorm?" she yelled. "He wasn't in that room." "Sorm ain't here. Can't you tell? This was a setup. We gotta get..."
He brought his legs in and popped to his feet. For a big guy, he moved fast.
"Where is he?" she yelled, scanning left and right. "I don't know. For all I know, he wasn't ever even here. Come on, we gotta vamoose."
He moved alongside her and turned so they were facing in opposite directions with a 360-degree view of the room between them.
"How do you know he wasn't here?" she shouted.
"I don't know. All I know is who was here. Three professional badasses in body armor who'd likely have punched my ticket if you hadn't been here to stop them. Do you get it? Sorm knew we were coming, or I was coming, or you were coming, or whatever. Lord have mercy, can we please discuss our theories of whatever the fuck just happened once we're safely away?"
"What if he went out through the room? It has a back door."
"I know it does, but if he was here, that's the way he went. I'm going after him."
From the direction of the entrance, she saw three men fighting their way through the crowd.
"Shit," she said. "The security guys from the entrance."
"Don't kill them," Texas said. "They're just doing their jobs. They've got nothing to do with Sorm."
She knew it was true, but she was so close, and if these men tried to stop her...
"Just let me handle it," Texas said. "All right, lose the goggles and put away the gun. Trust me, otherwise we're going to have another gunfight, and I swear, two in a day is my absolute limit."
Still, she hesitated.
"I'll get them to go the other way, all right. Just do what I say."
Certain she was making a fatal mistake, she pulled the goggles and dropped them in the purse, followed by the Glock. Texas didn't say another word. He just slipped the gun back under his shirt, squeezed one of her hands in his, and started waving frantically at the approaching guards with the other.
"Thank God!" he shouted. "Thank God you're here! Oh, my Lord! They're shooting people over in that karaoke room and singing Elton John!"
He pointed in a direction away from both the entrance and Sorm's VIP room.
"There! Over there! Do you hear me? For the love of God, hurry! I'm scared! I'm scared!"
The security guys took off. Livia shook her head, amazed it had worked. People really fell for this guy's hick routine. Without another word, she pulled the Glock and took off straight into Sorm's safe room.
"Damn it, don't!"
Texas said from behind her, but she didn't care. If there was any chance Sorm had been here, she was going to kill him. She leaped over the bodies of Sorm's Thai guards and into a room filled with acrid smoke. The back door was open. A riser of fire escape stairs lit up in cold fluorescent light behind it. She bolted straight through.
"Wait!"
she heard Texas call from behind her, but she didn't even slow. She hit the stairwell and tore downward four steps at a time. She could hear Texas's footfalls echoing just behind her.
"They might be expecting this, damn it!"
she heard him shout. She didn't care. She couldn't let Sorm get away. She couldn't. She heard Texas close behind her, and then somehow he was past her, moving so fast he was pinwheeling his arms for balance. He nearly fell, but managed to grab a banister at the riser below them and stabilize himself. He threw an arm around her waist and caught her. She wanted to sweep his legs and keep running down the stairs, but for some reason held back.
"Listen to me," he said. "Just listen. The guy who arranged all this for me, the intel, hacking the door locks, everything, he's supposed to have contractors waiting on the ground floor behind the fire exit. If this thing is on the up and up and Sorm went that way, the contractors already have him. And if it ain't on the up and up, then the guy those contractors are waiting for is me. We can't go out that way. There's no upside, only danger. Please, just listen to me. We'll get Sorm another way."
She recognized on some level that what he was saying made sense. But still, she couldn't. She just couldn't.
"No," she said. "He was here. He was... Damn it, we can't go out that way. More bad guys could be expecting us, don't you see? Please, you seem like a nice lady, and I don't want you running straight into a damn ambush. I can tell you mean business with Sorm. So do I. Trust me, okay? We'll get him."
He was right. She hated it, but he was right. She shook loose from his arm. "The guest room floors are all locked," she said. "We can only get out on the lobby level, or the parking lot, through the fire exit."
"I can get my guy to pop the locks."
"The same guy you're worried set you up?"
"I see your point, but if I just keep things general, we ought to be all right. Hold on."
He pulled out a cell phone and called someone.
"No," he said. "No, I didn't get him. I don't even think he was here. There were three operators, though, who I just barely survived, no thanks to you, I might add."
There was a pause.
"We'll talk about that later. Right now, I just need to get... Can your geek squad pop the locks on every floor in the fire escape stairwell?"
Another pause.
"Don't you worry about which floor. You just have your guys pop all of them."
Pause.
"When? 5 minutes ago would be nice, but I'll settle for right fucking now. Thank you very much."
A second later, there was a loud metallic clack from the door behind them. Livia pulled it. It opened.
"Good to go," Texas said into the phone. "I'll check in again when I'm settled, and you best look into why this thing went so damn sideways, 'cause somebody knew I was coming, that is for damn sure."
He clicked off and powered down the phone, then slipped it into the shielded case.
"Let's put yours in too," he said. "Better not to take chances."
She realized it was a Faraday case, and that her phone was still on. With everything that had happened, she had forgotten to turn it off. She didn't like handing over her phone, but under the circumstances, a Faraday bag made sense. In fact, she should have been carrying one herself. Seattle PD couldn't track a powered-down phone, but she didn't know what Homeland Security was capable of. She turned off the unit and handed it to Texas, who enclosed it in the case and then, to her surprise, handed the case to her.
"Here," he said. "Keep it in your bag. With two phones, it's a little thick for the belly band, and I don't want anything in the way of my gun besides."
That also made sense. She put the case in her bag, then pulled off the wig and glasses and stuffed them in, too. She wanted to look different from what witnesses might be describing. She arranged everything to make sure the Glock was on top, easily accessible. They went through the door, then moved quickly down a long, wide corridor, passing guest room doors, the plush carpet and high ceiling creating a hush that felt bizarre after the club's viscera-grinding electronic music.
"Hey,"
Texas said. Hey, slow it down. We're just hotel guests now, remember? Maybe heading back to our room for an amorous nightcap. She looked at him, still enraged at having been so close to Sorm and being forced to abort.
I'm not saying that's actually happening, he went on, but you gotta act as if.
I know how to act as if.
Well, I expect you do. I can see that. But right now, you're acting as if we're having some kind of tiff. So that's what anyone who encounters us is going to see. And I can work with that if you like, of course. But I think it would be less unusual and therefore less noticeable if we could pretend to get along for a little while, at least until we're out of the hotel.
We're getting along fine.
You see, that's what I'm talking about. When you say it like that, it just doesn't sound like your heart's in it.
She heard the elevator chimes from down the corridor, maybe 50 feet away.
Shit, Texas said. Take it easy now. We ain't gonna shoot anyone till we see the whites of their eyes, okay?
Stop telling me what to do.
I meant it more as a suggestion. Now here's another one. Get your arm around me now. Act as if.
He put a hand on her waist and pulled her close. She stiffened, again wanting to sweep his legs and leave him there while she went on alone.
Here on Earth, he said, it's customary to relax and enjoy this kind of human contact. And if you don't, people will notice.
She heard the elevator doors open. A second later, two uniformed hotel rent-a-cops turned into the corridor and started heading toward them. Their pace and posture were relaxed, a routine patrol, not an emergency. But still she stiffened. Texas squeezed her close.
Easy, darling, he whispered into her ear. Easy, just two strolling lovers, lost in the rapture of their mutual desire.
He waved to the guards, and she saw him give one of them a wink as they passed. She didn't like any of it, but it seemed to work, and she understood the purpose was operational, or at least part of the purpose. With this guy, she realized she just wasn't sure. They took the elevator to the parking level and went out through a side exit, each of them scanning for trouble as they moved. There were a dozen police cars parked around the hotel and approaching sirens from more, and a lot of gawkers lined up, trying to figure out what was going on. But the two of them just kept walking arm in arm through the warm Pattaya night until they were clear of the hotel grounds and no one paid any attention.
I parked my bike at the pier, Texas said. Let's head that way. Don't you worry. We'll get Sorm. Just not tonight.
When Little pulled that shit, it felt like forced teaming. But with Texas, somehow it didn't. And besides, he was obviously no friend of Sorm. They'd do better together than at cross purposes. But that didn't mean she trusted him. She didn't trust anybody. Chapter 22. In just a few minutes, they had nearly reached the pier. Docs couldn't figure this lady out. She was obviously a pro, though what kind he couldn't quite say. And any pro would know they'd do better walking arm in arm like lovers than like two strangers who didn't like or trust each other. She had to know it wasn't real for him. He was just acting as if. Or, okay, maybe it was a little bit real. She sure was pretty, and there was definitely something about her. And besides, after a gunfight, didn't everyone want to be held at least a little? He saw the bike in the lot, easy to spot because of its size, and instantly realized something he should have thought of earlier.
Hang on, he said. My helmet's chained to the back, but we need to get you one, too. They don't enforce helmet laws out here so strictly. But we don't want to take a chance on some cop looking for a bribe. Plus, it'll prevent anyone from seeing our faces.
It took only a moment to find a guy pulling off his helmet after parking.
Hey, Doc said, whipping out a Benjamin and pointing to the helmet. $100 US for that helmet there. Deal?
The guy looked at him like he didn't understand, which he probably didn't.
Well, it was always dumb to just talk louder when someone didn't speak your language, but maybe money was different.
He pulled out another Benjamin and extended the bills with one hand while pointing at the helmet with the other.
$200, sir, and that's my last offer. Take it or live with regret for the rest of your life.
The guy gave him a big Y and a bigger smile. He took the money, handed Docs the helmet, then headed off, probably to buy new headgear and spend the excess on various forms of Pattaya Bacchanalia. Docs handed the helmet to the woman, and they kept moving. They came to the bike. Docs unlocked and shouldered the chain, grabbed the helmet, and started to swing a leg over the seat. The woman put a firm hand on his shoulder, stopping him.
I'm in front, she said.
She might as well have told him she would fly them to the moon.
Look, he said, feeling flummoxed. This is a Kawasaki Z800, a touch big for a little lady like...
Maybe I'm not as little as you think, or you're not as big.
Well, that stings, I won't lie.
Get on and back.
Look, it's customary here and throughout the civilized world for the man to ride in front. Doing it the other way is just going to get us noticed.
He might have added, or killed in a crash, but thought that might be a tad incendiary under the circumstances.
You're wasting time.
He wanted to argue, but she seemed so determined. Plus, he couldn't think of anything else.
Fine, he said. I hope you know how to ride.
He also hoped no one, and especially not Rain, would ever learn about this. She pulled on the helmet and held out her hand for the key. He scowled, but that only made him feel more helpless.
Fine, he said again.
He handed her the key. She swung a leg over the seat. He pulled on his helmet and got on behind her. She fired the ignition, revved the engine, and turned her head toward him.
Hold on tight, she said.
Fine, he said yet again, feeling like an idiot.
He put his hands on her hips.
Tighter, she said.
Well, all right then.
He clasped his hands around her belly. Damn, her stomach was hard and flat. Whoever she was in some shape.
And damn, it was a good thing he'd listened when she told him to hang on, because she hit it suddenly and hard, the back of the bike fishtailing in the dirt as she accelerated, but she compensated instantly with her body weight one way and then the other, and never seemed other than completely in charge. At the street at the edge of the lot, she accelerated more, leaning into the turn and showing great throttle control, then rocketed ahead to the intersection and turned again, carrying a ton of speed through the corner. Docs clung to her, bug-eyed under the helmet, wondering what the hell he'd gotten himself into.
In under 3 minutes, they were heading northeast on Route 7, the main road back to Bangkok.
Wait! Doc shouted over the whine of the engine. We don't want to go to Bangkok. Make a ride on 36 up there ahead.
She didn't even slow.
I have another lead on Sorm in Bangkok. Look, generally in my life, when strange men show up unexpectedly and try to kill me, for at least the next day, I try to avoid doing anything that might be predictable. So please indulge me. We can always go back to Bangkok. I just don't want to go there right now. Go southeast on 36. It'll take us to Rayong and Sangshan Beach. We'll spend the night there and use another route into Bangkok tomorrow.
He knew his advice was sound. As sound as advice ever got, and she was obviously a pro, so she must have already known what he was saying made sense. But even so, he could tell she was struggling.
I know you want Sorm bad, he said, but you gotta also want him smart.
Even as he said it, he realized he was getting himself into a potential jam. He wasn't supposed to kill Sorm, after all. He'd even promised Van and Kanazaki he wouldn't. But he was certain this woman sure as shit was going to kill Sorm or die trying, and now he was practically offering to help her. Well, he'd have to figure all that out later. For now, they just needed to get safe. He didn't know what he would do if she ignored him and tried to stay on Route 7. It wasn't as though he could grab the handlebars, but luckily it didn't come to that. She slowed as they approached the sign for 36 and turned smoothly onto it. An hour later, they were in Rayong. Docs hadn't been here in probably a decade, but even at near 3 in the morning, he could tell it hadn't changed much. Palm trees, low-slung buildings, and not a walking street all-night party scene in sight. Apparently, being an hour farther south from Bangkok than Pattaya, it had been spared the overdevelopment suffered by its more famous coastal cousin. They drove slowly east on the beach road, everything sleepy and still under a low crescent moon, the waves of the Gulf of Thailand to their right breaking white along the sand.
See how they've done the beach in all those semicircles of sand and stone? He said. Like half moons. That's where the name comes from. Sang Chan means moonlight.
She turned her head slightly.
Where are we going? All right, I can see my attempts at playing tourist guide have come to naught. Just keep heading up the beach road. There's a little place where I used to stay back in the day. I'll bet you it's still here.
And it was. Paradise Cottages and Spa was the name, a collection of thatch-roofed bungalows strung out along the south side of the road, directly across from the semicircles of the beach. The woman parked the Kawasaki, and Docs dismounted. He was glad the gravel lot was dark and empty so no one could witness his shame as he got off the back of the bike. Still, he had to admit she could ride and then some. He pulled off his helmet. There was a breeze coming off the water, and the night air was pleasantly cool. He could smell the ocean, a clean, salty smell Pattaya had buried under diesel and concrete. And another smell, durian fruit. There must have been a tree nearby. Most Westerners hated the smell, but for him, it was one of the delights of being in Southeast Asia. The woman cut the engine and pulled off her helmet. He was quick to extend a hand. "Key, please." He half expected her to argue, but she didn't. It was his bike, after all. She handed him the key.
"What are we doing now?" she asked.
He was grateful to be back on familiar ground, at least somewhat in charge.
"What we do now is get a room. Just one room, 'cause we have a lot to talk about. Not to mention..."
"You want us to act as if?"
"Just act is all. I'm not trying to take advantage of you."
He thought she was going to argue, but she just said,
"I know."
That threw him. He couldn't get a fix on what made her cooperative and what turned her obstreperous.
"Oh," he said. "Well, good. And you know I might put on a little show for whatever tired clerk we encounter, right?"
She swung a leg off the bike and dismounted.
"Yeah, I'm starting to pick up on that."
"Well, it's just a show. I got two ways of hiding. One is to be invisible, and the other is to make a spectacle of myself. Each has its advantages and disadvantages."
She laughed. It was only a little, but it was the first time he'd seen her do it. He liked it. It made him strangely happy to know it was even possible, and to think maybe he was the cause.
"You invisible?" she said. "That I'd like to see."
He smiled.
"Well, that's the thing. You wouldn't see it. That's the whole point."
"Okay, then. You just let me know when it happens."
"Deal. But for now, it's going to be more spectacle. So when we go into that guest reception bungalow over yonder, I'm going to put my arm around you, 'cause we're a couple of semi-randy homo sapiens whose pheromones mixed at a bar a while back and who are now planning on acting on their mutual attraction here at Paradise Cottages and Spa."
He'd been trying to make her laugh again with that, but instead she frowned.
"You don't have to talk to me like that," she said. "I'm not an alien."
That threw him again.
"Well, hell, I know that. I'm sorry. I was actually just trying to make you laugh. I liked when you did it a minute ago. You have a nice laugh, and that was the first I'd heard it."
For a moment, she didn't respond. Then she nodded and said,
"Let's just go in. I'm tired."
He couldn't figure her out. All he knew for sure was she was carrying an almighty weight and couldn't find a way to set it down. They went in. He put his arm around her as promised, or as warned anyway, and without being prompted, she did the same. Under any other circumstances, he would have been glad that she was listening, that she trusted him, hell, maybe even that she was starting to like him. But the way she did it seemed so reluctant and somehow sad. He wanted to prompt her again about acting as if, but decided it just wasn't worth it. It was 3 a.m. in Rayong. Nobody was going to notice an incongruity as minor as an Asian woman seeming reluctant about a big white guy having his arm around her. Hell, he thought, it's probably not even a damn incongruity. It's probably more the damn norm. Either way, the clerk, a teenager who'd been out cold with his head on the desk when they came in, didn't seem to give a shit. He wiped his eyes, took Doc's cash, and handed him a key. Doc thanked him, and he and the woman went back out and walked along a gravel path lit by dim footlights until they found their bungalow. It was a nice place, and just as he remembered it, spare but cozy, with polished wood floors, white sheets, and French doors that opened right onto the beach. The lights were on a dimmer, and he kept them low so as not to attract insects. He opened the doors. Rain would have considered it an unpardonable breach of security, but for God's sake, Docs himself hadn't known until 10 minutes earlier that this was where they were going, and the room was immediately filled with the sound of the ocean, not 50 feet away. He smelled the durian fruit again. "Mmm," he said, "I love that smell."
"Durian?"
she said from behind him. He stood there for a moment, his eyes closed, just enjoying the smell of the fruit and the sound of the waves.
"You bet. Call me strange if you like, but it's one of my favorites."
She didn't answer. He glanced back at her, and she was staring at him with the oddest expression. They'd stopped at a convenience store on the ride in and picked up some sandwiches, chips, and bottled water, and after a moment the woman got up, tore the bag open, and started devouring one of the sandwiches. He walked over and did the same. Being in a gunfight made a person ravenous. It increased all the appetites, in fact. He'd have to watch himself. She was pretty, and he liked her, and he was definitely suffused with that incredibly alive feeling you could have only when you survived someone trying to kill you, and you got to kill him instead. But she sure didn't seem a fan of human contact. They stood and ate wordlessly, and the sandwiches and half the water were gone in minutes.
"Whew," he said, holding back a belch. "I needed that."
She nodded.
"I think we've got some notes we ought to compare," he said, "but I could use a shower. If you'd like, you're welcome to go first."
She shook her head.
"I'm fine."
"You sure?"
She nodded again.
"Hey, when I come out of that bathroom, you're still going to be here, right?"
She looked at him.
"Why do you say that?"
"I don't know. I just can't figure you out."
"I'll be here. Just give me a minute first."
She went to the bathroom and came out a little while later, looking different. She'd been wearing makeup, he realized, and had washed it off. He liked her better this way. He almost said so, but then decided it wouldn't sound right. The shower was heaven, roomy, clean, and with great water pressure, and he would have loved to linger and unwind in the steam and the heat. But they did have a lot to cover, and though he believed her when she said she'd still be around when he got out, he didn't think it would be a good idea to give her too much time to reconsider, either. He dried off, then brushed with the hotel-provided toothbrush and toothpaste. There was a whole complement of toiletries, in fact. Comb, brush, cotton swabs, even earplugs, though who would ever need earplugs in a sleepy place like this? Well, maybe reprobates who didn't like the sound of waves on the beach, or who suffered the misfortune of a snoring partner. Earplug fetishists, maybe. About the only thing the hotel didn't provide, it seemed, was a condom, which was unusual, as in his experience with such establishments, and in fact, back in the day with this very establishment in particular, the hotel-provided condom was considered both chic and de rigueur. He looked at his duds, which he'd left in a pile on the floor. The thought of getting back into clothes so sweat-soaked and road-grimed after a good shower wasn't appealing, so he pulled on one of the hotel robes instead and hung the clothes on the shower rod to air them. He'd buy some new ones tomorrow. She was sitting on the couch when he came out, her gun on the coffee table within easy reach. The Glock 21, he saw. Kind of a big gun for someone her size. On the other hand, she'd driven the Kawasaki like a pro. She still looked tense, and he wished she'd taken a shower. It might have relaxed her some. It sure had him. "There's another robe," he said, taking the other end of the couch and turning so he was facing her. He placed the supergrade on the coffee table alongside the Glock. "Might be more comfortable than that little cocktail dress, though you do look fabulous, I won't deny, especially after surviving a gunfight and fleeing by motorbike through the dead of the sultry Thailand night." She smiled again. She had such a nice smile. It made him sad that it took so much to coax it out of hiding.
"Hey," she said, "before, in the hotel stairwell, you said your guy had contractors waiting for Sorm at the fire exit, and that if Sorm went that way, the contractors would have him."
Damn, she had zeroed right in on the very contradiction he knew he was going to have to grapple with.
"That's right," he said.
"What did you mean by that? Why contractors? Why have him? You dropped those guards. Why wouldn't you just kill Sorm yourself? After the flashbang, he would have been helpless."
"Well, this is the part where I have to say it's complicated, and I hope maybe you can help me figure it out."
He cleared his throat.
"All right, here it is. Some people hired me, ostensibly to have a frank conversation with Sorm, but it turned out to be a setup, and they were trying to get me to converse with Sorm's enemy. So now, I find myself embroiled in all that skullduggery, and my best way out of it is to finish the conversation, if you know what I mean. But at the same time, I'm hemmed in by circumstances."
Omitting names and being general about the details, he told her about Gant and Van and the indictment in New York and Kanazaki and Sorm being a CIA and DIA asset and Zatoichi and how he'd promised to bring Sorm in, not kill him. Rain would have had a fit that he told her so much. But come on, she was obviously no friend of Sorm, though in fairness, he knew his inclination to trust her wasn't only that.
"I had a feeling he was on the run," she said when he told her about the indictment. "One of my leads told me he'd switched to a burner and needed fast cash."
That tracked with what he'd learned from Van.
"Yeah, because of the UN guy, Van.
Van told me Soren must have gotten wind of what was coming and hightailed it. He told her more about how the guy he worked with had tracked Soren to Pattaya, about the plan to capture him.
So even if Soren was there, she said, and even if he went out the back door of his safe room, you didn't know for sure that he'd take the stairs all the way to the ground level and go out the fire exit where the contractors were supposedly waiting.
Man, she really had a nose for potential inconsistencies in a story.
That's true, he said. Like I said, the plan was for me to be hot on his heels to that level and more likely to drag him by the scruff of the neck. But without that, then, yeah, even if he was there, which I seriously doubt he was, and even if he went out the back door of his little VIP room, if he had a hotel room key, he could have gotten out of the stairs at any level he liked.
That seemed to satisfy her, or at least she didn't ask about any other inconsistencies. When he was finished, he thought she was going to argue about how capturing Soren was bullshit and how they had to kill him, which, now that he talked it through, he figured was an easy compromise. He wouldn't kill Sorm, he'd just help her do it. It wasn't like he'd promised to protect Sorm, after all, only not to kill him. So this lady could do the actual coup de grace. That way, Dox's promise would be intact, and the world would be a better place, too. But instead, she said,
"Why are you telling me so much?
Am I oversharing?"
She gave him that small laugh again, which he liked.
"It's more than I would have told you."
"It's more than you have told me."
"What do you want to know?"
"You're a cop, aren't you? Or at least you were one."
She didn't flinch. She didn't show anything at all. But something snuck through. In her face or her eyes, it was too subtle to describe. But it was enough.
"Why do you say that?"
she said.
"You're a hell of an interrogator, for one thing. You stay on inconsistencies like a bloodhound on a scent, meaning, okay, could be a cop, but could be a gator, an interrogator, maybe Air Force, I guess I could see that. But you said you had a lead on Sorm, and that one of your leads told you Sorm had switched to a burner. That sounds cop to me, not military." She didn't answer. "And besides," he went on, "no gator I've ever known could shoot for beans, maybe at target practice, but not when the bullets are flying the other way. Where'd you learn to shoot like that?"
"My uncle."
"Who's your uncle, Wyatt Earp?"
"Where did you learn?"
"The U.S. Marine Corps, though I'm a sniper by temperament and training, and prefer to avoid gunfights up close. Okay, your turn."
She didn't answer.
"The thing is," he said, "even if I'm barking up the wrong tree, and I don't think I am, I'm in the right neck of the woods. You're a pro, I can see that, but at the same time, I can tell this isn't professional for you. The way it is for me."
"It's just professional for you?"
He thought for a moment.
"Well, it's funny you would ask. When I came out here, it was. But then I met this nice lady in Phnom Penh, Chantreya, and got to know her and saw a few things, and I don't know. I guess it has gotten personal, and not just because I tend to find myself irritated when people hire me under false pretenses and then try to kill me on top of it."
"How is it personal for you?"
He was starting to see that it wasn't just that she didn't talk much. She was good at keeping the other person talking, too. Well, he didn't mind. He liked to talk. And maybe he was being played, but he thought if he kept talking, it might coax her into reciprocating.
"Where I come from, we have a saying. Actually, we have a lot of sayings, including, 'A turtle doesn't get up on a bookshelf by itself,' which is one of my favorites. But the one I'm referring to is, 'Some people just need killing.' And I think this guy Sorm is one of the people the expression was invented for. How about you?"
There was a pause. She said,
"I've known a lot of people like that."
He looked at her and felt the oddest mix of emotions. Understanding. Admiration. Compassion. And gratitude, because he realized all at once she wasn't playing him. He knew what it must have cost her to say even that much. And to a stranger, no less.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I've known a few myself, but not the way I think maybe you have. And I'm sorry. For what it's worth, I'm glad to know you, and not just because you saved my ass back at Les Nuits."
She looked at him. She seemed more wound up than ever, like she was fighting something inside herself. At the same time, he thought he saw something new in her eyes, I wasn't sure what. Fear or vulnerability or something. It was like he'd hurt her just by saying he was glad to know her.
Then why? She said.
He thought for a moment.
Because, among other reasons, we've killed people together. A lot of folks might find that an unusual means of establishing a bond between people, but in my experience, it's actually surprisingly effective.
She gave him that reluctant smile, but the look in her eyes didn't change. He realized how much pain that periodic smile masked. He wondered why he hadn't seen it before.
"What's your name, anyway?" he asked.
"What's yours?"
"Oh, right, I forgot. I always have to go first, and you don't go at all. But okay, people call me Docs, short for unorthodox. But my name, which pretty much nobody but my folks calls me, is Carl."
There was a long pause. She said, "I'm LaBee."
"That's a pretty name."
She looked away. Damn it, he'd meant it too.
"What, do you think I say that to all the girls?"
But it was as though she didn't hear him.
"Nobody calls me that either," she said quietly.
"Well, I could if you like." He held out his hand. "LaBee, it's nice to meet you. I'm Carl."
She looked at his hand but didn't take it. She shook her head and balled her fists. She glanced at him, and for a second, it looked almost like she wanted to hurt him. All at once, he didn't like how close that Glock was. Didn't like it at all. But she didn't go for the gun. She took his hand, but rather than shaking it, she used it to tug him toward her. Not suddenly or hard, but firmly, with a lot more grounding and power than he would have expected from her size alone. He was confused and wondered distantly whether she had some kind of martial arts background. Rain could move people like that, making it seem effortless. But before he'd had a second to consider further, she'd somehow twisted and spun him so his back was on the couch and she was straddling him, reared up with one hand tight around his throat and the other retracted in a fist like she was fixing to punch him. He was so startled he actually froze, though maybe that was a luxury he allowed himself because her hands were empty, and while the grip on his throat was no joke, it wasn't quite like she was trying to kill him with it either. She kept still and just stared into his eyes like that for a moment, like she was enraged or desperate or he didn't know what. And then she moved a little, rubbing against him. His eyes widened and he thought, "What the hell?" Well, his brain might have been asking, "What the hell?" But Nessie had no questions at all, responding instantly and dramatically to the friction and pressure. The woman felt it. How could she not? It was Nessie, after all. And besides, her little dress had ridden up when she flipped him, so that there must have been nothing between them but his robe and her panties. The thought aroused him more, and she started moving against him harder, riding right up and down and making the terry cloth of the robe feel good enough to drive him crazy. He put his hands on her hips, but she shook him off angrily and squeezed his throat tighter. Again he thought, "What the hell?" But he realized that with whatever this woman had been through, this must be how she liked it. Or maybe it was even the only way she could do it. So though he couldn't help feeling tense from the grip on his larynx and the nearness of the Glock, he let his arm settle to his sides and just went with it. She seemed to like that, maybe feeling she was achieving compliance or whatever, and relaxed her grip enough so he could breathe a little better. And then, without his even noticing where she'd pulled it from, he saw she was holding a condom. The one from the bathroom, he realized. She must have taken it while she was in there in case this happened, or because she planned on it happening. He was so bewildered by now that he didn't even move as she tore the wrapping open and eased forward onto his belly, then reached back with both hands and opened the robe. Panting now, she got the condom on over him, and then she brought her knees in and slid off the panties and moved back into position and eased herself right down onto him. The feeling was so good and so intimate that again, without meaning to, he reached for her, and again she squeezed his throat until he remembered himself and dropped his arms back to his sides. He stayed stiff and motionless after that, just watching her as she rode him harder and harder, her panting getting louder, more intense, and then her face twisted and she cried out, but she never closed her eyes. She just kept staring down at him, even as she came. And then he saw she was crying. He was weirdly turned on by the whole thing, but also too freaked out to come himself. Which was all right, not that he would have minded, but the main thing for him was always that the lady got to come. But then it was like she wanted him to, and she let go of his neck and put her hands on the couch past his head and looked at him and began to ride him even more violently. Her expression pained, her cheeks streaked with tears.